neurologist to make sure the palsy wasn't a symptom of something greater. After the doctors didn't find the brain tumor I was sure was there, they gave me an interesting prognosis. Both times I'd gotten palsy, I'd been under extreme stress. Like many women, I was working so hard and not taking good care of myself. I argued that this couldn't be the case. After all, I'd gotten sick again while on a romantic vacation. That's when Dave pointed out that it was the first vacation we'd taken in 3 years. 3 years of 60-hour weeks followed by 1 2-week break does not a decompressed girl make. I was also at the beginning of launching a business, and I was staying busy, desperate to prove myself. We were trying to get pregnant at the time, and though I was only 24, month after month after month had passed without a baby. Rather than managing that stress, I had just given myself more things to do. Our bodies are incredible. They can do unbelievable things. They will also tell you exactly what they need if you're willing to listen. And if you're not, if you try to do too many things without rest, they will absolutely shut down to get what they need. About 3 years ago, I started to develop symptoms of vertigo. I'd stand up at work and the room would sway around me. I felt dizzy throughout the day. My eyes had trouble focusing, and I spent most of my time feeling nauseous. For weeks, I assumed I must need more sleep, more water, or less Diet Coke. When it got so bad I was afraid to drive with my kids in the car, I decided to see a doctor. I saw so many doctors. Internists, allergists, ENTs, nobody could quite figure it out. I ate well, I was healthy, I ran marathons for goodness sake. They all agreed I had vertigo but couldn't definitively tell me why. Eventually, the ENT suggested it was seasonal vertigo brought on by my allergies, and since no one else had a better idea, I went with it. "Take an allergy pill every day," he told me. So I did. Every night, without fail, I took my pill. Sometimes, when the spinning got really bad, I took a second one, which made me crazy drowsy, but at least it calmed the vertigo. I did this for over a year, and resigned myself to the fact that life would be a little dizzier forever. It wasn't a big deal, I told myself. It only meant that instead of giving 100%, I now would need to give 130% to make up for not being able to work as fast anymore. It sounds crazy to write that, but in my overachieving mind, it made absolute sense. Then, about 2 years ago, I heard about a homeopathic doctor who specialized in vertigo. I'd never gone to a homeopathic doctor in my life, but at that point, if someone had said I could cure my constant nausea with voodoo and the sacrifice of a spring chicken, I would have seriously considered it. I went to meet with him, his ponytail, his shirt made of organic hemp, and his life-size statue of Ganesh, and I tried to keep an open mind while he talked into the air beside him instead of to me. I laid out the whole story of when I got sick and how it affected me, and he asked me 100 questions about my emotions, my childhood, and the deeper reasons why I felt a certain way. I kept thinking, when is he going to prescribe some medicine? Why are we still talking about stress, and what's the deal with that little collection of crystals? Before I'd gone to him, I assumed homeopathic doctors tell you to stop your sugar intake or, God forbid, stop eating dairy because it messes with your chakras or whatever. But after 2 hours of me talking, he abruptly interrupted and announced to the room, "No more! I know what's wrong." Then he blew me away. He pointed out that my vertigo had come on for the first time when I was under extreme stress at work. And every time it got so bad that I couldn't lift my head off a pillow, it was because the stress had gotten worse. That time I had a big turnover of staff at Chic? Vertigo. That time I was so excited to write my first contracted book, but then was positive it was terrible and I'd be fired and have to pay back the advance? Vertigo. In every single instance, my vertigo was a physical response to an emotional problem. A physical response to an emotional problem. I didn't even know our bodies did that. Okay, I knew it in the same way that every other God-fearing, law-abiding woman who watched Oprah and heard about self-care knows it. But I grew up in the country. I got a shotgun for my 13th birthday. I may have lived in L.A. for 14 years, but my rub-some-dirt-on-it tendencies run deep. His words hit me like ice water. And now that I knew he was right, I immediately wanted to know how to fix it and get back to normal. "Go home and do nothing," he told me. I'm sorry, what? "Go home and do nothing. Sit around, watch TV, spend an entire day on the sofa, discover that your world doesn't implode without you going 100 miles an hour, get up the next day and do it again. Verily I say unto you, dear reader," his words made me want to throw up. It sounds crazy. It is kind of crazy. But the idea of doing nothing makes my skin crawl. Even when I'm at home, I'm constantly doing something. If I'm not taking care of the kids, I'm organizing the house, cleaning out my closet, or giving myself a DIY facial. "What would happen if you stopped moving?" he asked me. I shook my head in blind panic. The image of a shark floating to the surface of the ocean, dead from lack of movement, came to my mind. All I could think was, "I don't know, but it will be bad." Talk about life-altering moments. Talk about someone holding a mirror up to your face and making you realize you're not actually the person you think you are at all. I spent my days thinking up ways to help women live a better life. And the whole time, I truly believed I was qualified to teach it because I was actually living it. Meanwhile, I wasn't doing the most fundamental thing a woman needs to do before she can take care of anyone else. Take care of herself. I needed a drastic life change. I forced myself to stop working so many hours. I went to the office from 9:30 to 4:30 and was shocked to discover that the world continued to spin on its axis. I pushed myself to rest, to sit and do nothing. It gave me massive anxiety, so I poured myself a glass of wine and I kept right on sitting there. I started volunteering at the local homeless shelter. I took a hip-hop dance class. Turns out, I'm terrible at hip-hop dance class, but I love it so much, I laugh like a toddler through the entire hour-long process. I looked for joy. I looked for peace. I stopped drinking so much caffeine. I played with my kids. I did a lot of therapy. And then I did some more. I prayed. I looked up every scripture in the Bible that talks about rest. I had dinner with my girlfriends. I went on dates with my husband. I taught myself to take it one day at a time, to stop obsessing over the next victory, and to appreciate the simple parts of today. I learned to celebrate accomplishments, not with big, flashy parties, but with taco nights or a great bottle of wine. I acknowledged my own hard work and the achievements of my company, and I learned to rest in the knowledge that I will still be okay even if both of those things go away tomorrow. I studied the gospel and finally grasped the divine knowledge that I am loved and worthy and enough as I am. Learning to rest is an ongoing process. Like any other lifelong behavior, I constantly fight the desire to slip back into the role I've played for so long. They say the first step is admitting you have a problem. And 2 years ago, I did just that. I learned that I am a recovering workaholic. But through this process, I also learned that I am a child of God. And that trumps everything else. Things that helped me. Number one, I went to therapy. This could be the first thing I list out for every single element I've worked through. But it's especially real in this case. Were it not for my therapist, I never would have understood the connection between my childhood insecurities and my adult accomplishments. Were it not for my therapist, I never would have realized that the drive for accomplishment can actually be harmful. I cannot recommend therapy enough, and if I had Beyonce's money, the first thing I'd do is pay for therapy for every woman I could find. Ask your friends to recommend someone they like, or ask your gynecologist to refer you. A doctor for your lady parts knows the right kind of counselors for a woman. Trust me. Number two, I hustled for joy. Work just as hard for fun moments, vacation moments, and pee-your-pants laughing moments as you do for all the other things. I encourage you to take a walk, call a friend, have a glass of wine, enjoy a bubble bath, or take a long lunch. All of that work will be there when you get back, and a little time away can recharge your batteries and give you the energy to battle that ever-growing to-do list. Number three, I reordered my list. When I ask most women to name the things on their priority list, they can throw them out there no problem. Kids, partner, work, faith, etc. The order may change, but the bullet points rarely do. You know what also rarely changes no matter how many women I talk to? Them actually putting themselves on their own priority list. You should be the very first of your priorities. Are you getting enough sleep, enough water, the right nutrition? You cannot take care of others well if you're not first taking care of yourself. Also, one of the best ways to ensure that you stop trying to run from your problems is to face them head on. Chapter 4. The Lie. I'm better than you. I feel the need to confess. I shave my toes. I totally do. Sometimes, not all the time, mind you, I look down in the shower and see my big toes sprouting locks long enough to braid. It's embarrassing, sure, but a quick swipe of my razor returns my toe knuckles to their usual silky smooth glory. None of this would be such an epic admission for me to make, except that I once made fun of a girl in freshman year English class for doing this exact thing. Blarg. I feel like such a jerk even now, 150 years later. Friends, let me paint a quick picture of myself in high school. I was a solid 20 pounds heavier. I wore clothes from the Goodwill, and I was the president of the drama club. I wasn't someone who teased others. I was someone who got teased. But there was that one instance when I did tease. The one and only time in my memory that I actively made fun of someone else. Maybe that's why it sticks out in my brain. Maybe that's why it still feels so shameful. We'll call this girl Shmina. Her actual name is Tina, but I'm trying to write in code here. Shmina was the girl who always seemed totally confident in herself. She developed breasts and a sense of humor light years before the rest of us, and she was popular in a way I would never be. One day, in Mrs. Giacchetti's English class, when we were supposed to be writing a paper on Zora Neale Hurston, Shmina mentioned something about shaving her toes. I don't know why she mentioned it. I assume popular girls share grooming tidbits the way the rest of us mortals talk about the weather. But anyway, while I didn't say anything to her directly, I talked so much smack about it to my best friend later that day. Who shaves their feet? More importantly, who has hairy digits in need of shaving? Shmina clearly has some kind of glandular disease she's not copping to. What a ridiculous conversation. Most people would have forgotten about a conversation like that by now, but it keeps haunting me years later because the whole time I was mocking Shmina and her hairy toes, I was totally shaving my own! To this day, hand to God, whenever I look down at my big toe and see that it's looking a little shaggy, I think about what a jerk my teenage self was. Rage flaw number one, hairy digits. Rage flaw number two, hypocrisy. A story about hairy toes, a girl named Shmina, and the adolescent angst I should have really worked through with a licensed therapist years ago may seem like the most frivolous topic ever. But then, I dare say that tearing down other women is usually based on something no less frivolous than the insecurities of our 14-year-old selves. Why do we do it, ladies? Why do we gossip? Why do we rag on each other? Why do we say hello on Sunday mornings with the same tongues we used to lash others behind their backs a few days later? Does it make us feel better about ourselves? Does it make us feel safer to mock someone who has stepped outside the parameters we deem acceptable? If we can point out their flaws, does doing so diminish our own? Of course it doesn't. In fact, the stones we most often try and fling at others are the ones that have been thrown at us. Have you ever shaved your toes? And what I really mean by that is, have you ever made fun of someone else? Have you ever pointed your finger in their direction and ignored the three other fingers on your hand pointing back at you? We've all been there, but that doesn't make it okay. Bringing others down won't elevate you. Recognizing that all words have power, even the ones whispered behind someone's back, is how you adjust your behavior. A few weeks ago, there was a woman on my plane from LA to Chicago. She and her husband were traveling with two boys, the youngest of whom was about four. He was also the worst behaved child I've ever seen. Before we'd even pulled back from the gate, he was screaming. And I don't mean a whine or a protest. I mean screaming bloody murder about having to sit in a seat when he wanted to run around. His mother had to forcibly hold him in the chair for at least half an hour while he hollered to be released. Everyone on the plane, myself included, was miserable until he stopped. But a little while later, when I got up to go to the restroom, I saw why he'd finally quieted. He'd been given a big bag of gummy worms to happily eat his way through. Friends, I will be honest with you. I was disgusted. First of all, as a strict parent who was raised by strict parents, listening to him scream, I thought, oh, heck no. All through takeoff, I was thinking about his mom. I was thinking about how she needed to discipline him better, have boundaries, get support from her spouse. And when I saw that she'd rewarded his bad behavior, and with sugar, keep me near the cross, Lord Jesus, I kept thinking, this woman doesn't have a clue. Later, at baggage claim, I saw the family again. The four-year-old was wild, jumping up on the stopped luggage belt, hitting his brother, and running around in circles while everyone stared. What is wrong with his mother? I kept thinking. Why doesn't she get a handle on him? Then I saw her standing next to the luggage carousel, utterly exhausted. When I really looked at her, I saw she was near tears, looking bewildered and totally overwhelmed. Her husband wore the same shell-shocked expression as their son ran in circles around them. And a gentle voice reminded me, "Rachel, you don't know their story." I was so humbled in my ignorance. Maybe this little boy had special needs that made it hard for him to control his impulses. Maybe this little boy was a new adoptive child who had struggled in foster homes for most of his young life, something I should be grateful about given what we've been through. Maybe this little boy was just badly behaved and his parents were struggling to discipline him because their older son had been so easy to manage at this age. Whatever the reason, I will never know, because instead of asking or offering the benefit of the doubt, I cast my judgment on her before I even ask myself why things might be this way. Women judging other women. It's been on my heart for a while. It's something I've tried to wrap my brain around fully so I could put it into words. I see it all around me in so many different ways, and that poor, tired mama on the flight to Chicago reminded me of what I want to say. What I want to say is that we all judge each other. But even though we all do it, that's not an excuse. Judging is still one of the most hurtful, spiteful impulses we own, and our judgments keep us from building a stronger tribe, or from having a tribe in the first place. Our judgment prohibits us from beautiful, life-affirming friendship. Our judgment keeps us from connecting in deeper, richer ways because we're too stuck on the surface-level assumptions we've made. Ladies, our judging has to stop. So does our compulsion to compete with everyone around us. Let me give an example of that, too. When I heard that some of my girlfriends were going to run the Nike Women's Half Marathon in San Francisco, I was excited. For some of them, it was their first race. I was also overjoyed because it would involve a weekend trip somewhere. I promptly invited myself along for the ride. The plan was for us to leave on Friday, drive the 5-ish hours between LA and SF, hang out in town on Saturday, then run the race and drive home on Sunday. Wait, scratch that. They would run the race. I would stand on the side of the road and clap for them while they jogged by. This felt especially interesting because I am a runner. And more than that, I am competitive about running. I like to challenge myself. I like to try bigger and better races. I like to beat my personal record and push myself to be the best. What I do not like, what I had never actually done, is cheering for others while they do something I am fully capable of doing right along with them. I kept thinking, what if I didn't need to prove myself in this situation? What if making myself into someone better has more to do with my willingness to be of service than my willingness to compete? So I went to San Francisco. In fact, I drove everyone to San Francisco because I figured the last thing I'd want if I were about to run 13 miles would be to drive 400 miles. It's worth saying that while I did all of this and had so much stinking fun with the ladies, I didn't always have a good attitude about my willingness to be a cheerleader. On Sunday morning when everyone headed out bright and early to the starting line, I got myself together and headed in the other direction, to the 5-mile marker. About 20 minutes into my journey, I realized it was unlikely that I would get a cab at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning. Around this time, I realized that walking alone in the dark in downtown SF might be one of the dumbest things I've ever done. I legitimately thought at one point, see, this is what happens when you try and do something nice. You get murdered on the streets of an unknown city. I get pretty dramatic when I'm in fear for my life and haven't had any coffee. Anyway, at that point, I decided to turn around and head for the finish line since walking there felt safer than walking to mile 5. Turns out, walking to the finish line meant walking up approximately 32 hills that were taller than some mountains I know. I was sweaty and grouchy by the time I arrived, grumbling under my breath about the whole ordeal and thinking, why on earth did I agree to do this? Then I saw my first elite marathon runner. Elite marathon runners are those superhumans who run a race in like 5 minutes. They look like cheetahs or gazelles as they fly down the road, and they are truly breathtaking to behold. As someone who ran 12.5-minute miles in my first marathon, elite female runners, by comparison, run like 6 or 7-minute miles. I was in awe. Since I'm always so far behind these athletes in the race, I've never been able to see one. I stood there and watched one after another sprint by and felt so blessed to see them in action. For the 2.5 hours that followed, I stood in that exact spot and cheered on strangers. I clapped nonstop, my skill as a preacher's daughter finally coming into play. I screamed until my throat was sore. I yelled all the things that encourage me when I hear them from the sidelines during a race. You are so strong. You're almost there. You can do this. And the last one is something I've never heard but always tell myself when it gets hard during a run. I yelled it over and over again whenever I saw someone who looked ready to drop. You've lived through tougher things than this. Don't give up now. Finally, it was there, in that exact spot, that I got to see my friends Katie and Brittany jogging up from mile 12 in their first ever half marathon. You can see it in a picture someone shot of us. I'm screaming like a maniac and trying not to throw myself over the fence to attack them with hugs. I was so proud of them, I was laughing and crying as if their achievement was somehow my own. I jogged alongside them, outside the track, wrapped up in the joy of the moment, and I heard God very distinctly say, "Imagine all of the things you would have missed today if you'd only been out here for yourself." I never would have seen the elite runners. I never would have been there when my friend Hannah ran her personal best, 13.1 miles in under 2 hours. I wouldn't have been able to stand next to Joy, who put my cheering to shame. After running her own race, she screamed louder than anyone from the sidelines, encouraging the other runners. I wouldn't have been there to hug Katie and Brittany. I wouldn't have seen any of it. I would have run another half marathon like I'd done 10 times before, and I'd have nothing to show for it but a little extra pride and the banana they give you at the end. The first step toward getting past the desire to judge and compete is admitting that nobody is immune. For some of us, we judge in little ways, rolling our eyes at the way someone is dressed, frowning at the badly behaved child in the grocery store, or making assumptions about another mother at school pickup who has a serious expression and wears a suit every day and seems uptight. For others, judging is a bigger problem. Berating your little sister because her views are different from yours. Viciously gossiping with other women. Taking to social media to write hateful things to people you don't even know simply because they've stepped outside the lines of what you think is good. The second step is recognizing that just because you believe it doesn't mean it's true for everyone. In so many instances, judgment comes from a place of feeling as though you've somehow got it all figured out when they do not. Judging each other actually makes us feel safer in our own choices. Faith is one of the most abused instances of this. We decide that our religion is right. Therefore, every other religion must be wrong. Within the same religion, or heck, even within the same church, people judge each other for not being the right kind of Christian, Catholic, Mormon, or Jedi. I don't know the central tenet of your faith, but the central tenet of mine is love thy neighbor. Not love thy neighbor if they look and act and think like you. Not love thy neighbor so long as they wear the right clothes and say the right things. Just love them. Yes, I also believe in holding each other accountable. But holding each other accountable takes place inside community and relationships. Holding each other accountable comes from a beautiful place in the heart of friendship that makes you sit down with your friend and ask with love if they've ever looked at their own actions in a particular light. Holding each other accountable comes from a place of love. Judgment comes from a place of fear, disdain, or even hate. So be careful about dressing up your judgments as accountability to make your conscience feel better. I have worked tirelessly over the last couple of years to create content that caters to women. I have spent numerous hours trying to figure out exactly what women like us want in life. Do you know what they want? Do you know the number one thing that I hear most, get emails about most, get asked for advice on most? Friends. How to make friends. How to keep friends. How to cultivate real, valuable relationships. That's what women are craving. That's what they really want and hope for. And if that's true, we have to start at the beginning. We start from the beginning and we teach ourselves to keep an open mind. We begin with that first hello or handshake and we stop ourselves from making decisions not founded in fact and experience. We look for commonality instead of seeking out differences. We ignore things like hair or clothes or weight or race or religion or socioeconomic background. We pay attention to things like character and heart and wisdom and experience. And no, it might not be easy, but I promise you, it will be worth it. Your tribe is out there. And if you haven't found it yet, I challenge you to consider that maybe your people come in a different package than you thought they might. Things that helped me. Number one, non-judgmental friends. We often become whoever we surround ourselves with. If your friends are full of gossip and vitriol, I promise you'll start to develop the habit. When you're looking for a community of women, look for the ones who want to build each other up instead of tear each other down. Number two, policing myself. If we're already judgmental, and let's be honest, most of us are, we have to work hard on policing ourselves. When I find myself judging someone in my head, I force myself to stop and think of compliments about that person. By doing this, I'm learning to look for the positive instead of reaching for the negatives. Number three, dealing with it. Usually our judgment and gossip come from a deep well of our own insecurities. Get to the bottom of what's going on with you. What's making you lash out at others? The first step toward becoming the best version of yourself is being honest, truly honest, about what makes you tick. Chapter 5. The Lie. Loving him is enough for me. I fell in love the first time I saw him. Does that sound dramatic? Probably. I'm not even sure I was aware of it at the time, but the scene plays out so clearly in my memory. I went out to the lobby to get my boss's 11 o'clock appointment. There was only one man standing there. His back was to me, hands down deep in his pockets. He had a beat-up leather messenger bag slung over his shoulder. I noticed the bag first. I remember thinking it was so cool that this guy wore business clothes but carried a worn-in leather bag instead of a briefcase. "Excuse me," I said as I crossed the lobby. "Are you here to meet with Kevin?" In my mind, he turns around in slow motion. The memory illuminates when I first see his face. He smiles at me and reaches out a hand to shake mine. The moment stretches into infinity, then snaps back together like elastic. It speeds back up into real time. "Something just happened," I distinctly remember thinking. I was equal parts excited and terrified. He was older and totally out of my league. Still, I caught myself thinking, but maybe. That maybe is what did it. My curiosity wouldn't go away. It was enough to startle me, to make me wish I was wearing something cuter than a black maxi skirt and an ill-fitting matching t-shirt. That day wasn't the first time I'd spoken to him. He called to talk to my boss often. It was the first time I'd spoken to him in person. I'd had no idea what he looked like, or more specifically, that he was so handsome. And what had been a business relationship quickly turned into something more flirtatious. It's important to note here that I had zero experience with men. I'd been hired as an intern during my first year of college. That summer, they offered me a job, and I promptly dropped out of school to accept it. I had just turned 19 years old. At this ripe old age, I had smooched a couple of boys in high school, but I'd never had a real relationship and had never been on a date. I might have been professionally mature beyond my years, but when it came to romance, I had the life experience of an amoeba. Our relationship progressed over email and staring at each other during business functions. It's probably also fair to tell you that I had my big sister's ID. So at those business functions, I ordered a glass of wine like everyone else. Given the job I had, this man never thought to question my age. I also never willingly volunteered the information. It's also worth telling you that he was 8 years and a lifetime of experience ahead of me. He asked me out on my first real date, and I spent days trying to figure out what to wear. I was a little surprised to find him dressed so casually when I arrived. It was telling in retrospect, his preparation for this date versus mine, but I can only see that in hindsight. We walked down the street to a little Italian restaurant. I tried to keep it cool, though internally freaking out that we were on a date. I was so nervous. I worried that he would try to hold my hand or kiss me or both. I had no idea how to handle either situation with grace, and I prayed fervently that I wouldn't be put into a position to figure it out. We were seated at a table. We ordered a bottle of wine. "I hope you're not one of those girls who's afraid to eat on a date," he laughed. It annoyed me. Whoever or whatever kind of girl I was hadn't been determined yet. I didn't like the comparison to anyone else. Didn't like the reminder that this wasn't his very first date, too. I responded by eating more than half the pizza we were sharing. He talked about himself for 2 hours straight. I didn't mind. I was fascinated. That night, when he walked me to my car, I thought I might be sick. I was 99% sure he would try to kiss me, and I felt confident that I wasn't a girl who kissed on the first date. I mean, I had no practice with this theory, but it felt like the truth. So when I went to throw my bag into the front seat and turned around to see him leaning in, I immediately threw both hands up in between us, real graceful-like, and yelled, "Don't kiss me!" He paused, a deer in headlights, before chuckling like some sexy leading man. "I was going to give you a hug," he told me. He reached for my hand and gave it a firm shake. But just to be safe. It was so charming, I wanted to die. My mortification knew no bounds. I drove away from that date bemused and a little bit in love. I was positive, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I would marry that man. After one meal of pizza and cheap red wine, we were officially dating. Or at least, I thought we were. I didn't know there were rules. I didn't know there was even a game. Soon, after that first date, he asked me out on another, this time for soup at an ultra-hip restaurant that was popular at the time. Only in L.A. can you unironically invite someone on a date to a trendy local soup joint, and nobody finds it odd. A week later, he asked me when I graduated college, because, dude, I still hadn't told him my age. On some level, I knew he wasn't going to be happy about our age difference. The email I wrote him back, because this was before text messaging kids, started with, "Well, this should be interesting." He responded like a champ. He told me I was Doogie Howser, and I did feel like some sort of child prodigy, because not only did I have this job, but I was also in a real relationship with a grown-up. I didn't know it at the time, but on the other side of that email, that grown-up was very unhappy. It came up on our next date. I was too young, I was too inexperienced in every way, and he didn't want to be the guy that hurt me. Can you believe me when I tell you that I didn't hear him at all? I mean, my ears were working just fine, but my brain couldn't even process the idea. I kept thinking, how in the world could you possibly hurt me? We're going to get married and have babies. It's going to be awesome. I mean, bless my tiny, ignorant heart. He resisted, but I was dogged in my pursuit. I thought I was mature enough to handle it. I went quickly from never having gone on a date to spending every night at his apartment. For clarity's sake, let me spell it out. At that point, we weren't having sex. But honestly, that was a technicality. Are you supposed to admit all of this when you write a book for a Christian publisher? I have no idea. But I know for a fact that I am not the only good Christian girl who fell in love with a man and threw every ideal she'd ever believed right out the window because nothing mattered to her more than being loved by him. A month into our relationship, we went to a party at my friend's house. And because I was a tiny baby bunny, I introduced everyone to my boyfriend that night. "This is my boyfriend. Have you met my boyfriend? Who's he? Oh, that's just my boyfriend." Ugh, I cringe at the memory. I also cringe remembering the next day, when he was clearly upset with me but wouldn't tell me why. I kept asking until he finally gave a frustrated huff. "You've never acted your age before, but last night, it was like it was written on your shirt." Ouch. On the one hand, in a lot of ways, he was right. I had always been incredibly professional at work and mature when we hung out. But in this instance, I didn't know the rules. I didn't understand that you couldn't just call a guy your boyfriend without a discussion. I naively believed that if someone had seen your boobs and you regularly went to dinner together, it meant you were a couple. Just to put a little more truth on this, I had zero guilt about the whole "here are my boobs" thing because I believed we were getting married. I justified my choices because I thought they were part of the bigger story of us. Meanwhile, this man didn't even believe we were dating. 34-year-old Rachel can see all of this so clearly in hindsight. 19-year-old me was in love and insecure, so I justified everything he said or did that was hurtful. It's hard for me to write all of this down. It will be hard for my husband to read it. Dave is so different from that man, and it will be tough for him to learn, in detail I've never fully shared, how much this treatment hurt me. But here's the deal. I am not the only woman who ever let a man treat her badly. It's important to tell my story because I believe some of you may find yourself in a similar situation now. And I hope you get out of the trees long enough to see the forest. In telling my story and my truth, I hope it can help some of you make better choices than I did, or see your reality for what it actually is. Because here's the ugly truth. I was a booty call. The preacher's daughter, the one who hadn't ever been on a date, the conservative good girl, I drove to this man's house every single night he asked me to and pretended that it didn't gut me when he wouldn't acknowledge me during the day. When we were together, he was so sweet and so loving that it held me over during the times when he wouldn't call. On the rare occasions when I'd meet up with him at a bar and his friends would ignore me, or worse, refer to me only as the 19-year-old, and he wouldn't say anything to stop them, I made excuses. I was like the overweight girl at school who makes fun of herself before anyone else can. I acted as though I was in on the joke, that I was a joke, that I wasn't worth defending. When he would flirt with other girls in front of me, or invite me somewhere just to ignore me all night, I told myself to play it cool. He'd reacted so badly when I called him my boyfriend, and I'd learned enough to know that if I brought up any of this, I'd be seen as clingy. I took whatever scraps he gave me, and worse still, I was thrilled to receive them. As I write these words, I'm crying. I didn't cry when I wrote the chapter about my brother's death or the pain of my childhood, but this flays me. I am so sad for that little girl who didn't know better. I am devastated that nobody prepared her for life or taught her to love herself so she wasn't so desperate to get any form of it from someone else. I'm sad that she had to figure it out on her own. I'm disappointed that it took her so long. It took me a year, a whole year of whatever you want, whatever you need, whatever you think is best. A year during which I tried everything I could think of, tried to be everything he wanted, attentive but not clingy, pretty without trying too hard, funny and smart and cool, nice to his friends even when they treated me like garbage, caring and thoughtful when he wanted me around and never bothering him if he didn't call me first. Toward the end of that year, when his company moved him to another state and our already tenuous relationship was threatened, my virginity went from technical to non-existent. It was the last best way I could think of to hold on to him. It didn't work. 2 months after he moved away, he flew home long enough to break up with me. He wanted a clean break, he said. He needed a chance to really put down roots in his new city, he said. He cared about me, he said. It just wasn't going to work out, he said. We'd always be friends, he said. I can see it perfectly in my mind, though I don't often remember that day in real detail because it was so heartbreaking for me. My bed had a bright pink and orange IKEA comforter, and as I sat in the middle of it, I wept. The memory makes me lower my head, and it brings my heart to its knees. You may read this chapter and feel anger at the way that man treated me, or anger at the position I'd put myself in, but I didn't see any of it. I had no pride. I sat in the middle of that neon duvet, and instead of standing up for myself, I begged him not to leave me. He left anyway. I cried myself to sleep that night. The next morning, I got into my car and drove to my hometown 2 hours away to spend Thanksgiving with my family. That day was miserable. Use your imagination to dream up the kind of conversations I was forced into by well-meaning Southern aunts when I'd been dumped. Jesus wept. When I got back in my car to drive home that night, I saw that I had a voicemail. Somehow, I knew he'd call me that day. It was routine, after all. He would do something hurtful, then I would accept it and wait by the phone to see if he wanted another go. I held off listening to that call for the 2 hours it took me to get back to my apartment. I dialed the number for my voicemail and stood immobile as I listened to his message. He was just checking in on me, he said. Wanted to make sure I was okay. It was a divine moment in my life. Never before or since have I experienced such total clarity. I stood in my crappy Hollywood apartment and saw our relationship like a map before me. There was the spot where we first kissed. The detour when we didn't talk for 2 weeks after I called him my boyfriend. The night he flirted with the popular girls from work in front of me. Then there was the day I first heard the line, "We're not together, but we're not not together." I saw that phrase and platitudes like it scattered like mortar shells over the terrain. There was the first time he called and asked me to come over after getting drunk at a bar I wasn't invited to. For a year, I'd only looked at the pretty parts of our relationship, and for the first time, I made myself see what was really there. "Who are you?" I asked my empty bedroom. But that was the wrong question to ask. The issue wasn't that I didn't know who I was. The problem was that I didn't know who I had allowed myself to become. It might surprise you to know that I don't blame him for anything that happened that year. Though he was a grown man, he had his own baggage. He was young and immature in his own way. People will treat you with as much or as little respect as you allow them to, and our dysfunctional relationship started the first time he treated me badly, and I accepted it. I called him back, just as I had 100 times before, but this time I was totally calm. I had no anxiety about what he might think, and I wasn't excited to talk to him. When he answered the phone, he immediately launched into questions about how I was feeling and if I'd had fun with my family, as if we were old friends catching up, as if he hadn't eviscerated me the day before. "Hey," I interrupted him. He went silent. I like to believe there was something in my tone that made him pause, but perhaps it was simply startling because I had never interrupted before. Calmly, and without any dramatics, I told him, "I am done with this. I am done with you. Don't ever call me again." It wasn't a bid for attention, or an attempt at playing hard to get. I meant every single word. "Why?" he choked out. "Because I don't deserve to be treated like this. Because I can't go back and forth. Because I don't like what I've become, but mostly because you said we were friends. This whole time, whatever else has happened, you told me I was your friend. I don't want to be friends if this is how you treat someone you care about." I meant those words with every fiber of my being. I hung up on him and shut off my phone. I brushed my teeth and put on pajamas. Then I went to bed and crawled under that pink blanket and went to sleep dry-eyed and peaceful for the first time in months. I remember that night as the first time I really felt like a grown woman. I woke up to someone banging on my front door. This is the great part of the story. This is the moment that feels like a movie or a romance novel. This is where I tell you that I woke up and found my husband on the other side of my front step. The man who treated me badly, who had strung me along, and who couldn't make up his mind was lost somewhere between his parents' house and my apartment that Thanksgiving night. I know it seems dramatic, but that's really what happened. I remember everything in our relationship as either before or after this moment, our love story being reborn. And it is a love story. Our relationship is the greatest gift in my life. Dave is my best friend, the first real caretaker I ever had, and I have had the honor of watching him grow from that guy into a wonderful husband, father, and friend. But every story is not perfect. Very few roads to love are easy to navigate, and ours was no exception. But it's important to me that you know that while our journey hasn't been easy, the 14 years since that first really crappy one have totally outweighed the mistakes we both made. It's important for me to tell you this story because it is the story of us. My husband is brave and humble to support me in sending it out in the world in hopes that it might serve someone else. It's also important to understand that I don't believe this is typically how it works out. Opening the door that night and finding Dave on the front porch begging me for one more chance feels special because it was special. What is far more likely to happen in most cases is that as long as you allow someone to treat you badly, they will continue to do so. If you're not able to value yourself, no one else will either. I hesitate to even tell you the ending because I don't want anyone to use it as an excuse to stay in an unhealthy relationship in the hopes that it will become healthy. Our story ended well, but that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been willing to walk away. That night in my bedroom, I hit the point where I couldn't live one more day without self-respect. I couldn't stay with a partner who didn't truly value who I was as a person. Sometimes, choosing to walk away, even if it means breaking your own heart, can be the greatest act of self-love you have access to. What else can I tell you? What can I offer you as insight or wisdom or what I hope you receive from this chapter? I hope that if you read yourself in my story, it will hold up a mirror for you. I hope you'll get out of the trees long enough to see the forest for what it is. I hope that those of you who have lived through something similar and carry guilt about it long after it's over will learn that you are not the only one. So many women have made mistakes or done things they regret or become versions of themselves they aren't happy with. So many other women have survived and come out the other side stronger because of it. Every day you're choosing who you are and what you believe about yourself, and you're setting the standards for the relationships in your life. Every day is a chance to start over. Things that would have helped me. Number one, a sounding board. When I walked through this season, I didn't really have any close friends or mentors who could advise me. I think if I'd been able to speak with someone wiser, I might have become aware sooner of how unhealthy my relationship was. Be careful anytime the only voice of advisement is your own. Your judgment is easily clouded when you're in love. Number two, being prepared. When my children are old enough, I will tell them this story. I know it doesn't paint either of their parents in the best light, but I want them to learn from it. If I had been less naive and known more about self-respect, I think I would have seen our relationship for what it was. Number three, someone else's shoes. If you told the story of your relationship, both the good and the bad, would there be more good or more bad? If a friend or a stranger heard about my relationship, and if I walked them through all of the stuff that was hurting me, I can't imagine them not wanting to shake me until my teeth rattled. Imagine someone else describing your relationship to you. Would they say your relationship is healthy? If the answer is no, or if you even have to question it, I beg you to take a deeper look at the relationship in your life. Chapter 6. The Lie. No is the final answer. When asked to be a keynote speaker at a conference, I usually get to choose, to some extent, what I will talk about. Sometimes it's about business life or a more niche area of expertise, such as event planning, but the one thing most of my speeches have in common, the one thing I truly believe myself to be an expert on, is being told no. Truly, I've been told no in so many different ways and by so many different people that sometimes it seems as if life itself is saying no. I am an expert in rejection. Or more specifically, I am an expert in bouncing back from rejection and fighting my way toward my goal. I suppose if I can gift you anything in the reading of this book, it's that no is only an answer if you accept it. So allow me to use one chapter of this book to, I hope, light a fire under your butt. I want you to be so pumped up that you can hardly stand it. I want you to have one of those nights when you stay up until 1 a.m. writing long lists of big dreams and plans. You know those nights when you're so excited you can't shut off your brain and you end up having to take a Benadryl just to fall asleep? Yes. I want these words to excite you that much. I'm hoping some of my excitement rubs off on you, which, granted, would be way easier if I were giving you the speech in person, but I promise to use lots of italicized words for emphasis and to tell you about the word no and the role it's played in my life. I waited years for the opportunity to explain my relationship with rejection. A lifetime, maybe. About 6 years ago, Inc. magazine named me as one of their top 30 entrepreneurs under the age of 30. Ooh la la. It was a huge honor. I mean, clearly, because I'm still talking about it. But the really interesting thing that most people don't know is that when you get a prestigious title like that, almost immediately, you begin to make hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Just kidding. No, what happens is every college within a 100-mile radius immediately starts calling and asking if you'll come and talk to their students. Since I haven't stopped talking since the moment I figured out how, of course I accepted every single request. Each of those sessions lasted about an hour, which consisted of 30 minutes of me chatting about my career and my company and 30 minutes of questions and answers. After a while, I could almost time to the minute when I would hear the classic question. "Hi, Rachel," they'd always begin, because apparently we call adults by their first names now like we're a bunch of hippies. "Can you tell us the secret of your success? Like, what's the one thing that truly gives you an advantage over others?" First of all, God bless our youth. God bless these wee infants who believe that a lifetime of hustling and working and sweating and stressing and building a company could be summarized with one single answer. But I tried. At first, when I was asked this question, I would give generic answers. Hard work, dedication, making yourself indispensable, blah, blah, blah. But the more I went to schools and realized it was going to be the one question I got asked every time, I decided I'd better figure out the truth. So I began to ask myself questions. What led to this massive platform and all of these fans? How did I get book deals and TV appearances? Why was I the one standing in front of the classroom answering questions? Why not somebody else? I think the obvious place to start is my family connections. So after graduating from Yale and then later Harvard Business School, I began working in my family's oil business. I later went on to be part owner of the Texas Rangers before becoming governor of that great state. And then, I mean, most everyone knows that my father was a former president. So when I decided to run for president myself, wait, no, that's not me. That's George W. Bush. No, as a reminder, I grew up in a place called Weed Patch. That wasn't like a cute name for locals. That's literally its moniker on any map that wants to include it.